It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm David Leet, in this week for Lynn Rosetta Casper. We've heard that the link between good nutrition and brain health is significant. And having a particular interest in this, I asked Dr. Drew Ramsey which foods are crucial for maximum brain health.
Seafood, greens, nuts, and beans. The average American eater needs to decrease their red meat and processed meat intake. And one great way to do that is replace it with some seafood, wild salmon or wild shrimp, or add in a little ceviche. Leafy greens, of course, nuts. They're a wonderful way to add protein and healthy monounsaturated fats to your diet. And then they're full of all these phytonutrients, like all plants are. And beans, again, just more plant-based proteins. And people don't know this, the top antioxidant-containing food is not the blueberry. It's the small red bean.
Brain food and a celebration of the flavors and heritage of Eastern Europe. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm David Leet, guest hosting this week while Lynn and Francis are away. Nutritional psychiatry is a relatively new term in the fields of mental health and food. The premise is that by eating foods that are good for your brain, you're also, get this, boosting your mood. Dr. Drew Ramsey, a psychiatrist, assistant clinical professor at Columbia University, and the author of the upcoming book, Eat Complete, sat down with me in New York to discuss the surprising effects good food can have on anxiety, depression, and your overall mood. Drew, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Explain how you came to this position of food as medicine.
I think this is what happens when you turn an Indiana farm boy into a New York City psychiatrist. So I'd always been interested in food in my personal life. For years, I was a vegetarian. I think like a lot of people, really focusing on eating to be healthy. And then I became a physician. I came out to Columbia and became a psychiatrist. And we don't talk about food in mental health or in psychiatry very much, even though we talk about a lot of compounds in food. And I think the moment for me was talking with a patient and needing another tool in my toolbox, and realizing food presents an incredible opportunity. The fork then becomes a really nice intervention for a psychiatrist. I mean, especially if I want to prescribe something really delicious and gorgeous and that connects you to you and your friends and family with great food. But you have to have a healthy gut to have a healthy brain. And besides the nutrients, there is this new cool piece of science about the microbiome, all of the bugs living in the gut, which we don't usually talk about. I think this book is unique in the sense that it's weird to talk about bacteria in a cookbook in a positive way. So the microbiome are all the your inhabitants, your silent passengers, so trillions of bacteria in the gut, and they dictate a lot about our immunological system and our mental health and brain health. So there's a lot to do with the gut and how we feel, and all those brain signals we're looking for, good moods, sharp thinking, lots of focus, lots of energy, that's all brain phenomena.
I read that you actually prescribe food to help people with depression, help people with anxiety. And being someone who suffers from bipolar, I was fascinated by that because I thought maybe there's something else I can do on my own that's non-medical and non-medication to help myself.
Well, David, I love hearing that actually, because that's the exact intention of the book. What else can people do in their own lives, you know, whether you have a diagnosis or not, to help us feel our best? And I think you already know about that. I suspect you, as a cook and a chef and someone who loves food, there are those moments that you use food and you nourish yourself. And it's a meal that's good for you and you know it's healthy. Because the way that brain food works, and the way I think it helps people with a diagnosis or without, just trying to have optimal brain health, is that there are foods that are more nutrient dense. They have more of these special nutrients that our brain needs, things like omega-3 fats and vitamin B12 or iron. And when we're deficient in these nutrients, or when our diet is low in them, our brains just don't function as well. Take vitamin B12, it's a very good example. That just causes people to get depression. It causes their brains to shrink faster as they age. So what are the top foods with vitamin B12? Shouldn't we be prescribing those for our patients instead of just saying, oh, you should take your multivitamin or a B12 supplement?
Right. And why not supplements?
I think the road to health is paved with food, not with supplements. And so I'm all for, if you have a deficiency, if you have a specific condition, sure, that makes sense. In the winter, I give my patients vitamin D supplements because they're deficient.
Right.
But I also make sure that they know that mushrooms And oysters and other fatty seafood are the top dietary sources of vitamin D, because at every meal, I want people to be getting those nutrients. That's how you build a better brain. And also, supplements frighten me a little bit. They're totally unregulated. You want to scare, go to the FDA website that looks at recalls of natural supplements. It's right. Terrifying. And so for my patients and for my prescriptions, I like to stick with the stuff from the farm. You know, some people are big pharma. I'm little farmer. Right. So I think that's really where the best medicine comes from for the foundation of your health.
What are the most important foods to be able to get into your diet for maximum brain health?
Yeah, I have a little rhyme that I've been using for a while. Seafood, greens, nuts, and beans. And don't forget a little dark chocolate.
Right.
So the seafood is something that we see people missing. Just this is your source of omega-3 fats. And if we think about what most eaters need to do, the average American eater out there needs to decrease their red meat and processed meat intake. And one great way to do that is replace it with some seafood, wild salmon or wild shrimp, or add in a little ceviche here and there. There are great ways to do seafood. Mussels is one of my favorite, again, because there's so much nutrient density, not a lot of calories, and just six oysters has 500% of your daily need of zinc.
Right.
So so seafood, leafy greens, of course, just because that's a great base. Right, you swap out a lot of the empty carbohydrates you get from things like pastas or breads, and you can use some leafy greens and again, just lots of nutrient density. The nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Nuts, first of all, they have 25% fewer calories. The USDA just released last year saying, whoops.
We made a mistake.
We made a mistake. They're actually not that many calories in nuts. And nuts are just, they're a great snack. They are a great way to keep yourself full. They're a wonderful way to add protein and healthy monounsaturated fats to your diet. And then they're full of, again, all these phytonutrients like all plants are. So seafood, greens, nuts, and beans. Again, just more plant-based proteins and more great food for the microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
There's such a focus on and such a hype around probiotic supplements when really the best data about how to take care of your gut and your microbiome tells us if you eat more plants and if you eat more probiotic fermented foods, so that's kefir, kimchi, making your own sauerkraut, something. I mean, that takes cabbage, salt, and a mason jar. Easy to make fermented foods.
Right.
So we want more of those in the diet because those natural fermented foods are better for your health than a probiotic. And people don't know this. The top antioxidant-containing food is not the blueberry. It's the small red bean. So
right.
And
that's
traditional Mediterranean diets, Portuguese diets, you just see beans in there, even in the stews with the meat. So like feijoada, right?
Yeah.
Great dish where, again, you have that flavorfulness of the meat, but it's not all meat.
No, it's not.
And that's really one of the goals, is really to help people move towards a plant-based diet, because mostly what we want you eating is plants, but to have what I call sensible seafood and mindful meat. When you're going to be eating meat, be mindful about it for your own health and for the planet's health, and you certainly can do that.
When you're saying mindful when it comes to meats and also eggs and stuff, what kind of meat should we have? What kind of eggs should we have?
Yeah, so I really believe in the small farm. I'm from a small farm, and I believe that, boy, if you buy your eggs from somebody close, and you can do that now in America. Mm-hmm. That used to sound crazy. Now there are, by last count, 8,144 farmers markets in America.
Wow.
So you can shake your farmer's hand. So I like things that are grass-fed or pasture-raised, because when the animals are out like that doing what they do, when cows eat grass, the meat product's healthier, the dairy products are healthier, the yogurt's healthier. So I like things that are grass-fed, that are pasture-raised. Well, we're seeing that now. People say it's a trend, but you know, this is traditionally
right,
how we've always done it. So that's where you're going to get the healthiest products, in my opinion, for meat and for dairy.
Drew, it was a pleasure having you, and I look forward to reading and hearing more about your work.
Thank you so much, David.
Dr. Drew Ramsey is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. His upcoming book is Eat Complete. For more information about Drew and to find his recipes for whole roast chicken with anchovies and olives, which I have made and it's fantastic, and mussels three ways, which I've also made and is also fantastic, head over to our website. You know the address, splendidtable.org. And if you're not already following The Splendid Table on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest, why not? So go, follow, but wait till after the show. Relentless in their search for the best in fish shacks, barbecue joints, supper clubs, donut shops, you name it, Jane and Michael Stern track down great road food no matter where it takes them. They're the pair behind roadfood.com, and you hear them regularly here on The Splendid Table. Well, Lynn recently caught up with Jane and Michael between road trips.
Jane, Michael, so where have you been this week?
Well, we have been to Seattle, Washington, and eating breakfast at one of our favorite places called Glow's, GLO'S. And it kind of reminds me of Mel's Diner, you know, or one of those great old all-you-can-eat breakfast all-day places. But because it's Seattle, it's extremely bounteous. There's vegetarian options or vegan options, but absolutely everything you get there, including their specialty, which is Eggs Benedict, is top of the line.
You know what it reminds me of is the old-fashioned West Coast coffee shop, you know, which is kind of a dying breed of restaurant, a place kind of slightly higher level than a diner. It's not a greasy spoon. The food is kind of healthy. Service is fast. It's just a very pleasant place to be. And as Jane said, the menu is so varied. I mean, if you're a vegan or vegetarian, you know, you can have a wonderful meal there. Or if you need a lot of corned beef hash, they have a wonderful corned beef hash as well.
But Michael, you know, one of the things that struck me about Glow's is how humble it is. It's just a plain room. There's no decor except some pictures of old timers who've been eating there forever. I mean, there's nothing done up or fancy about it. And the focus is on the food. And it's one of those places that every time a plate comes up out of the kitchen with whether it's corned beef hash or Eggs Benedict or their beautiful huevos rancheros, everybody seems to stop and go, oh, you know, because it's like a work of art. Each plate is beautiful.
Is this expensive?
No. I mean, it's easy to have a hearty meal there for well under $10.
Oh, my. I didn't know that existed anymore.
Yeah, that's kind of why I wanted to make it sound as plain as it is, because it sounds like it almost could be one of these nouveau breakfast places,
no.
You know, where, you know, everything is fancy schmancy. I mean, the food here is delicious and very well made, but it is about as simple as you can get.
But it's really the quality that makes a difference. You know, I'm such a waffle snob. I don't like anything but the finest waffles. And especially, I don't particularly like Belgian waffles, but they have a Belgian waffle there that, first of all, the waffle itself is very good. But you can get it topped with blueberries, strawberries, blackberries, raspberries, and slices of banana, plus a garnish of pink grapefruit. I mean, it's just it's like a bouquet on top of the waffle, and it's really delicious.
Okay, I've got to know, what is Michael Stern's paragon of wafflehood?
You don't know by now, Lynn, after 5,000 years, that Michael only likes thin waffles. He doesn't like Belgian waffles.
Okay, and I don't know if I should even say this, but I actually like Waffle House waffles.
I knew you were going to say that.
All right, now Waffle House is a chain, right?
Oh, it's yes. It's there are millions of them.
All
and they're
right.
Open 24 hours.
And they make great waffles, right?
Truck drivers and stoned musicians at 3 a.m. after their gigs go to Waffle House. And Michael Stern.
You know, these are the important things that as reviewers, to share with the nation, it's really important.
My credibility is gone.
Hey, if they call themselves a Waffle House, they've probably had a lot of practice.
They do.
At Waffle House, the waffles are good only because you can put on heaps of butter and syrup. And they're really just a conveyance mechanism for that, you know. But at Glow's, the waffle itself is good and the fruit on top of it is amazing.
And you really know you're on the West Coast because every dish comes with, it seemed to me, like 3 pounds of ripe avocado sliced on top of it. You know, where I live in Connecticut, you know, you're lucky if you get like a 1-inch scrap of avocado. So it's very luxurious.
Well, you know, where I am, you have to take out a bank loan to buy an avocado.
Exactly.
Guys, this sounds excellent.
It is.
Run there.
Thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
You can find Jane and Michael Stern's road food picks and more information about Glow's at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Chinese food on the Mexican border. I'm David Leet. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm David Leet, guest hosting this week while Lynn and Francis are away. When you think about food on the California-Mexican border, tacos, enchiladas, tamales probably come to mind. They do for me. But ask people there about their most notable regional cuisine, and you know what they'll say? Chinese food. Reporter Lisa Morehouse sheds light on the history behind some dishes that you're not going to find anywhere else.
The Salcedo family sits in a coveted booth at the Fortune Garden restaurant in the city of El Centro. Myra Salcedo, her sister Marta Kramer, their mom, and other sister are almost drooling waiting for their food to arrive.
We come all the way from Yuma, like twice a month just to eat here.
That's Yuma, Arizona, over an hour away. A huge side order comes. Light yellow, deep fried chilies. It's a dish I've never seen.
We always order the chili, but my sisters, she eats them all.
And their next order comes.
The salt and pepper fish. It's like red fish.
Sort of like a Baja style fish.
The chili peppers and onion and stuff like that.
Baja style at a Chinese restaurant?
To us, it's like a fusion, Mexican ingredients with the Chinese. It's very different than if you go to any other Chinese, Americanized Chinese restaurant.
And there's a reason for this fusion, one that dates back over 130 years. I'll get to that history a little later.
And so, yeah, you just mix it.
For now, I leave the Salcedo family as they carefully mix Chinese mustard, a little spicy sriracha, and ketchup into a special, only an Imperial Valley dipping sauce for barbecue pork.
When they order, they don't say barbecue pork. They say carnita. Yeah, carnita colorada. My name is Janessa Zhao. I'm and my husband own the Fortune Garden.
Zhao came to the U.S. from southern China. Her husband, Carlos, from Mexicali, where he worked in Chinese restaurants. In the Fortune Garden kitchen, the cooks speak to each other in Cantonese. The waiters speak Spanish and English.
You can see every table, they have lemon. Hot sauce. Chinese food, you don't eat lemon, right?
Those fried yellow chilies on almost every table, chili asado, they're served in a lemon sauce with lots of salt, kind of a margarita flavor. If you believe the rumors, some chefs marinate pork in tequila, and they serve pato asado, roast duck, with lots of cilantro.
The restaurants that you see now are kind of the remnant of the Chinese population that used to fill the U.S.-Mexico borderlands in Mexicali and in Baja California.
Robert Chow Romero is a professor at UCLA. He teaches in both the Chicano Studies and Asian American Studies departments.
Chinese started to go to Mexico after the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed in the United States.
In 1882, the Chinese were the first ethnic group specifically singled out and banned from entry into the U.S. So tens of thousands went to Cuba, South America, and Mexico.
The Chinese invented undocumented immigration from Mexico, smuggling with coyotes,
guides hired to lead people across the border,
and smuggling with false papers and in boats and in trains. The infrastructure for that was all invented by the Chinese.
In fact, today's Border Patrol grew out of the Mounted Guard of Chinese inspectors. Many Chinese immigrants settled in Mexicali, becoming grocers, merchants, and restaurant owners. Others managed to smuggle across and make lives in the U.S., including Imperial County. A block from the border in Calexico, California, George Lim pulls up in a big truck.
So how do you like our fair city?
And drives a few minutes.
We're at the international border, crossing into Mexicali.
He lives in the U.S. but helps run one of the oldest and most grand Chinese restaurants in Mexicali, called El Dragon. There, he goes by Jorge Lim.
Why not have a restaurant in the U.S.?
I mean, population here, about 1 million.
Imperial County's population is about 170,000.
So just doing the math is, I mean, it's plain simple that you're going to have a lot more customers in Mexico. And I hate to say this, but people in Mexico are more sophisticated there in the Imperial Valley about Chinese food.
That sophistication may come from the decades of people eating Chinese food here with some Mexican flavors. 70 years ago, it was a necessity. Chinese cooks used Mexican ingredients like chilies, jicama, and certain cuts of meat because that was what was available. Now it's part of a culinary legacy, like this new dish on the menu.
Arrachera, which is the best meat for tacos.
beef served with asparagus and black bean sauce. The meat's clearly Mexican.
Asparagus could be both Chinese and Mexican, but the sauce, the black bean, that's Chinese.
And in a kind of Mexican-Chinese-American hybrid, there's an egg roll with shrimp, cilantro, and cream cheese. It seems like it shouldn't be good, but it is. And this is the only place I've ever seen avocado in fried rice. George Lim's father, Canuto, came to Mexicali in 1954. He's developed many of the inventive dishes here.
Most people who open or work in the restaurants came to Mexicali with previous experience cooking and serving Chinese food. When these experienced chefs come here and put their heads together to share their knowledge of the trade, the Chinese cuisine gets to be really good. There's no better Chinese food than in Mexicali.
His son, George Lim, says a few restaurant employees recently arrived here from China under a special skills category. That skill? Cooking Chinese cuisine.
Usually they come for a better way of life, and we train them.
And sometimes these Mexicali-trained chefs move up north to work in Chinese restaurants in Imperial County.
One of the goals is to go to the U.S., have a better life for you and for your kids, give them a better education, maybe a better opportunity. They may be earning dollars instead of pesos.
The same reasons that drew their ancestors here from southern China 130 years ago.
Reporter Lisa Morehouse produced this story during a fellowship at Hedgebrook, a residency for women writers. For more information about Lisa's series, California Foodways, head over to our website, splendidtable.org. When you hear the word mamushka, you'd be forgiven if you think it might be related to babushka, the Russian word for a grandmotherly woman. Well, it turns out that is pure fiction. Aaliyah Hercules, a chef, food stylist, and writer, first heard the term in the Addams Family movie when she was a kid back in the 1990s in post-Soviet Ukraine. She and her brother immediately began using it to refer to their mother to mean, well, a young babushka, a strong young woman. In her first cookbook, aptly named Mamushka, Recipes from the Ukraine and Eastern Europe, Aaliyah writes about the memories of the foods she ate when she was growing up. It's a collection that might surprise anyone who equates this part of the world with bleak and gray. This cuisine is fresh. Cucumber salads and wilted sorrel, bright cheeses and fried pies. Let me just say that again, fried pies with fresh sour cherries. Aaliyah talked to our contributor, Washington Post food and dining editor, Joe Yonan.
Aaliyah, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure completely. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with an obvious question. Describe the flavors of the Ukraine.
One of the most common ones and stereotypical ones are, of course, it's dill. I mean, my photographer, when we shot the book, he said, Aaliyah, we should rename your book into dill, the cookbook. There is a lot of dill and we use it in everything. But actually, the taste of Ukraine, especially southern of Ukraine, where I come from, is freshness. Loads of herbs, kind of really balanced and complex flavors, like loads of sweet and sour. Amazing produce. These are the flavors of Ukraine. Like, there's no shortcuts. You can't use bad ingredients because we don't have many spices to hide behind. So you have got to have amazing vegetables and really, really good quality meat. You don't have to have it every day, but, you know, once a week, if you have like some really amazing free-range organic pork, these are the flavors.
I'm fascinated by the ingredients that you talk about in
sure.
your book. And so I thought I'd ask you about something that, you know, we all think we know here, which is the gherkin pickle. We think of them as these little vinegared pickles. But I think in your experience, they're something much better than that.
They are. We don't actually use much vinegar in Ukraine for pickling stuff. We ferment stuff, which is a great and trendy thing right now. And, you know, when I saw this trend happening, I was just like, hold on a minute, guys. This is something that I actually grew up with. Because of necessity, really. We didn't do it for health kind of reason or for flavor. You know, we just did it because Ukrainian food was so seasonal. We grew so many wonderful things. And then in winter, we wouldn't be able to buy those fresh produce anywhere. So we'd just ferment it.
What do your gherkins, the fermented gherkins, taste like compared to ours?
My fermented gherkins taste of so many wonderful things. And most importantly, it tastes of wildness in a way. I mean, we make a little brine and we infuse it with some dill blossom. So dill tops, you know, if you can't find it, you can just use dill stalks. Then other aromatics like blackcurrant leaves. If you can't find that, it doesn't really matter. The main thing is that you get a weak brine. So some salt and some spring water, and you put your gherkins into it and you leave them out in your kitchen to go a little bit funky for a couple of days. And then once you can see that they start fermenting and the liquid is bubbling a little bit, you put it in the fridge. So the taste is, it's just incredible. It tastes alive. And if you keep them out for about 10 days, we call them yadrone agurchiki, which means they're kind of nuclear. Nuclear in the best kind of way. They're so strong. Like, it's not the vinegar kind of strong. You know, it doesn't make you go wince your face. It's more, I don't know. It's just so deep in flavor. I really love it.
I need those gherkins. So this might be the first book in a long time, Olya, that I have seen call for margarine. What is that about?
I know. I actually, you know, when I send my recipes to my publisher, I did say, okay, so my family recipes include margarine in it. If you want me to take it out, I will, and we'll just substitute it with butter. And then my publisher is just so nice that they said, look, as long as you put a note in and just say, this is all we could afford during Soviet Union, for example, you know, we want it to be as authentic as it was to your childhood. So that's why I left it in.
It was the 80s. That's what people used.
It was the 80s, yeah.
So I was so fascinated also to see you talk about sunflower oil. I had an unrefined sunflower oil for the first time. It was so nutty and so much different from the kind of boring ones that we usually see.
Oh, yeah. In Ukraine, unrefined sunflower oil is a real kind of thing. And also in Georgia, it's just incredible. My grandma lives opposite a place where they make it. So we just go there with our plastic water bottles and we just fill it up and then I smuggle it into the UK. It's so nutty and it just tastes of toasted sunflower seeds. It's not, I don't know if it's for everyone. Some people have been like, oh, it's almost like sesame seed. It's so strong, but you don't need much of it. You just pour a little bit on your salad and I think it's wonderful.
You're not typically using it for cooking then. It's a finishing oil.
No. You can't use it for cooking. It's just to be used raw. Like, you definitely can't use it for frying because it will just burn.
So, Olya, if you had to pick a favorite recipe in your book, what do you think it would be?
One of them is definitely the green borscht. You know, you make a really wonderful, rich duck stock, and then you serve it with some sorrel leaves and loads of herbs and spring onions and a little bit of chopped soft-boiled egg. It's just such an amazing recipe, I think. And another one is probably the chicken tabaka, the Georgian pressed garlic chicken. And the reason why it's wonderful is because when you cook it in the pan, it's got lots of butter and garlic in it to begin with. So it kind of gets confit in all of the garlic and butter. And then at the end, you mix it with this incredible combination of herbs. So you use red basil, if you can't find red basil, normal basil will do, dill, coriander, and a little bit of tarragon. And I know it sounds a little bit weird, but the combination of those herbs just makes it go pow. So you just add it at the very end to the butter and the garlic, and then you serve it with some bread, and imagine dipping your bread into that. It's a good dish.
Olya, the food just sounds lovely. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope it gets people excited about Ukrainian food.
Olya Hercules is author of Mamushka, Recipes from Ukraine and Eastern Europe. Joe Yonan is the author of Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. Now, you're going to want to head over to splendidtable.org to find Olya's recipe for garlicky Georgian poussin and Georgian plum chutney. Every week, our managing producer, Sally Swift, takes on home cooks' challenges with the able-bodied team from America's Test Kitchen. This week, it's Tucker Shaw, who heads up the Cook's Country team.
Hey, Tucker Shaw, great to have you back. Thanks for having me, Sally.
So I was digging around on your website the other day, looking at some fried chicken recipes, and around recipe 24, I kind of stopped looking. What is with the cult of fried chicken?
Oh, man. I mean, it's just so good, right? There's nothing wrong with fried chicken. Nice, juicy meat and a really crispy exterior. It's just a really, really popular dish. And there's so many different varieties of fried chicken around the country and around the world, to be honest.
So it seems to me, as a cook, that it's kind of a hard recipe to make. Is that true?
You know, I understand that. And I do think there is sort of an emotional price of entry, right, when you think about deep frying anything, really, because it sounds like it might be scary. It sounds like it might be a mess. But the truth is, it's not really that hard to do. And it's relatively difficult to screw up also. So if you can get over the idea of having to use a couple of quarts of oil on your stovetop, and then figuring out a way to get rid of that oil.
Right,
when you're
that's
done.
The barrier.
Yeah, and again, it's not that big of a deal. You basically just return the oil to the container that it was in. You can use it a couple of times if you like, but I wouldn't use it forever because it will take on flavors, and then toss it.
It seems to me that one of the great things about fried chicken is that they usually come with a story. They're often family recipes.
Well, I agree, and that's one of the most appealing things about fried chicken, forgetting how delicious it is. It always comes with a story. And one of the things that we focus a lot on in Cook's Country magazine and also on our website is finding these regional variations on recipes or regional specialties. And we travel to different parts of the country to find them. So we do a little bit of field work, and then we bring that knowledge back into the kitchen and develop a recipe that comes as close as we can get. You know, there's nothing better than eating the fried chicken in the kitchen of the person who invented that recipe. But second best thing is to be able to make it at home, and that's what we try to achieve. So we last year developed a recipe for what is called dipped fried chicken, or sometimes it's called just dip fried chicken. And this is a hyper-local recipe that we discovered in Salisbury, North Carolina, which is about halfway between Winston-Salem and Charlotte. It's a town of a certain size, you know, not huge, not tiny. But there in 1942, there was a man called Benjamin Franklin Cureton. And he and his wife, Nanny Stevenson Cureton, opened a place called Frankie's. And it was meant to be a burgers and hot dog joint. But they also put fried chicken on the menu, and it became a super popular dish on the menu. And in fact, people stopped asking for the hot dogs and hamburgers and just wanted the fried chicken. But the problem when you're selling fried chicken in a takeout place like Frankie's was, you can't really cook it to order because it takes, you know, 15 minutes or so to fry each piece. So they had to figure out a way to keep their fried chicken relatively warm so that when they gave it, handed it over to customers, they would have a warm lunch. So, you know, in a moment of invention, which is where, you know, kind of all the best things happen, or a moment of desperation, I should say, Nanny Cureton came up with the idea of dunking the pre-cooked chicken into a hot, what they call a dip. And it's really a sort of a vinegary sauce, much like many of the North Carolina barbecue sauces that you will find that have a very heavy vinegar presence. And they would sort of give the pieces of fried chicken a dunk in the sauce and hand it over. And it brought this really spicy, vinegary, really invigorating flavor to the exterior of the chicken.
Oh, it sounds delicious.
So good. But here's the thing. You've got fried chicken, right? And you've got this lovely, crunchy, craggy coating on the outside. And you dunk it into sauce, and you really run the risk of completely sogging out the exterior of the chicken. So that's a problem. But the solve to that problem is to create an extra crunchy exterior. And that's the thing that makes this chicken kind of so rewarding to eat, is you get an astonishing level of crunch when you, you know, grind it between your teeth. And to get there, we make a very simple mixture of flour, a bit of granulated garlic for flavor, some cornstarch to help sort of absorb whatever excess liquid might be lurking on the chicken. And the most important piece is baking powder. And now this adds a little bit of leavening to the coating, much like you would find in baked goods, to create little air pockets, which really gives you that craggy, crunchy exterior.
Oh, it sounds delicious. And then that gets dipped in the sauce, correct?
At Frankie's, they used to dip it in the sauce, but we drizzle. So we create this really spicy vinegary sauce and then drizzle it over the chicken. And it just like winds its way into the little crags on the exterior of the chicken and just fills it with flavor.
It just sounds great. I think this may be my first foray into fried chicken. Hey, thanks, Tucker. Good to talk to you as always.
Thank you, Sally.
Tucker Shaw manages the Cook's Country team at America's Test Kitchen. You'll find that recipe for North Carolina dipped chicken at splendidtable.org. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm David Leet. Okay, I am wicked psyched because I get to talk to you now. Pick up the phone and call us at 800-537-5252. Okay, we have Brian on the line. Brian?
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, David. How are you?
I'm doing well. Where are you calling from?
Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, Cincinnati. Great chili there.
It's different, that's for sure.
But I hear that's not your question. What's your question about?
No, I was actually hoping to talk tentacles with you today.
Okay. Tentacles, octopus.
It seems to have become such a trendy item in the restaurants, and I've been pretty fortunate in trying it several different ways. It's a little daunting to think about tackling it myself in the kitchen, but I think I'm kind of ready to try it. So,
good.
Looking for some advice on how to start, because I'm kind of lost.
Well, a lot of people are lost when it comes to octopus, and what you want to do is you want to make sure you have, first of all, a good octopus. And I would go for a smaller, younger octopus because it's more tender and it's easier to work with. You don't want this big behemoth of 4 pounds. So definitely start small. And I believe in the low and long process of cooking it low temperature, simmering it very low for a longer time, and that helps it become tender, and it also cooks it nicely. But for preparation ideas, here's some things that I think are a little bit different. One is you can braise in red wine. It's a great vehicle. The wine's a great vehicle for flavor, and you can put lots of spices and a lot of herbs in there, and I think it like cries out for things like chili pepper and bay leaf. It also stains it this beautiful, beautiful red color. You also can use white wine, too, and you can use a different flavor profile. How do you feel about chorizo and Spanish sausage?
Chorizo is delicious. Okay. I mean, anything spicy in general, too, would be great.
Excellent. Well, when I was growing up, my grandmothers would feed me something called chorizo y patatas, which was chorizo, which is our Portuguese sausage, like chorizo with potatoes. And when they cooked the chorizo, the oil would be left behind, and you could make chorizo or Portuguese chorizo and potatoes, and you can put them in the oven, you can bake them. But then the oil that is left over from frying the sausage, you can then fry slices of the octopus on a bias and then really sear it, and you get that nice smoky paprika flavor. And then mix it all in with the potatoes and the sausage, and that's pretty awesome.
That does sound good.
How do you feel about pickling?
Pickling, kind of vinegary.
Yeah, very easy to do at home. Just you'd cook it, you'd simmer it low and long, and then you would then put it in with some red wine vinegar or white wine vinegar, any spices you like. I think, again, chili peppers, bay leaf, coriander seed, black pepper, anything that really kind of gets you going, and put it in there, and then let it just steep for several days, little chunks of the tentacles, okay. And that's a great thing to pick at.
That sounds good. Definitely doable. Not as intimidating, so hopefully it'll go well.
All right. Well, let me know how it goes, and good luck with tentacles.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Bye-bye.
Why don't you call us with your questions at 800-537-5252. And right now we have Sarah on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Where are you calling from?
I'm from Amarillo, Texas.
Oh, the great state of Texas. Great place. So tell me, what is your question all the way down from the great state of Texas?
Well, one of my goals in 2016 is to try 12 new dishes from 12 new countries that I've never tried a dish from before. And making these dishes, it's a great way to travel with not ever actually having to leave Amarillo. And I was just wondering if there was any cuisines or cultures you would definitely hit something not to miss.
Well, first, bravo or brava. And what you're going to accomplish. I think that's fantastic.
So places that I think you shouldn't miss. Let me ask you this. Are you up for a little adventure?
Yes.
Little of the unknown?
Yes.
Yeah, a little risk-taking? Okay, let's do this. Because I can give you my list, but it's only going to be my list. And if you ask someone else, you're going to get their list. And I think what would be more fun is the unknown. Mm-hmm. So how about buying a map of the world and taping it to your kitchen wall? And are you married?
Yes.
Okay. Blindfolding your husband and spinning him around and play pin the tail on the country. And wherever that pin lands, that's what you're going to cook from. Mm. And it's what you just said. It's culinary travel. You can research. Yes. You can learn about it. And guess who becomes the expert in Yemen cooking or South African cooking? You.
Yeah.
In your neighborhood and circle of friends.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
All right. Well, when you do that, I want to know. So take pictures and you can send me all those pictures through the Splendid Tables website.
Very cool. Very cool.
Thanks for calling, Sarah.
Thank you.
Give me a call at 800-537-5252. Not too long ago, I put out a call on Twitter and Facebook for questions, and Susan tweeted me back with an interesting question about her toddler. And we have her on the line. Susan?
Hi, David.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from West Des Moines, Iowa.
West Des Moines, Iowa. Not East, but West Des Moines, Iowa. All right.
Correct.
So, Susan, I have to admit, I am not an expert in this area. I do not have a kid. I'm not really around toddlers. But I thought about your question. I thought, who would be a great person to speak to? So I reached out to a friend of mine who is the mom of all moms in a certain sense, Katie Workman. She's the author of the book Mom 100, and we're going to get her on the line right now to speak to you. So hang on a sec. Katie?
Yeah, hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Terrific. I've got Susan on the line, and she would like to speak to you about a question about a toddler. So Susan, go ahead.
All right. Hi, Katie. I have a 16-month-old little boy who loves to eat, and he loves rice. But I'd like to introduce some new flavors and textures to him. So can I substitute other grains in the dishes he likes that are made with rice?
Yes, you definitely can. And, I mean, good for you that you're already thinking about this, because I think one of the most common grievances I hear is people who have, you know, 10, 12, 14-year-olds who haven't explored the world beyond white rice. So the fact that you're looking to do this at such an early age is just great. And I am a huge whole grains fan, and I have been using, I mean, quinoa has kind of been a little bit of the darling of the grain world for a while, and it cooks up really quickly, and it's really mm-hmm. mild. It's actually a seed, not a grain, but that's, mm-hmm. you know, semantics there. But besides quinoa, there's quite a number of other grains, and you're not wrestling with any kind of wheat intolerance or wheat issue, are you?
Nope, everything is open.
Okay, that's great. I am a huge fan of farro, which is an Italian grain. It's sort of like barley. It's chewy. It's got a really nice toothsome texture. It's got a slightly nutty flavor. And, you know, besides cooking all of these up plain, you can add them to soups. You can add them to stews. You can, you know, mix them with chopped cooked vegetables. So there's, you know, you don't have to think of them just on their own. They make an amazing ingredient as well. So
can I cook these ahead of time and then mix them into dishes?
Sure, yes. A lot of people cook grains ahead of time and actually freeze them in small bags. Just press out all the air, throw it in the freezer in, you know, one-cup portions or whatever sort of suits your needs. Making them ahead, especially for some of the grains that take a longer time to cook. Some whole grains, everything from like brown rice to, you know, frika, those can take longer amounts of time to cook. So making them in a bigger batch is a smart thing to do. And unlike rice and even brown rice, a lot of these grains are actually complete proteins. So like quinoa is a complete protein. Amaranth is a complete protein. Amaranth is this teeny tiny little grain that you can pop, and it's so delicious, but it's hysterical because it's like the size of the head of a pin. And it's your kid might like it, actually. It's this sort of funny, like you could sprinkle it on yogurt or something like that, and it actually tastes like popcorn.
Oh, yum. These are great options.
I think your little guy is going to have a lot of interesting meals coming up.
I think it's perfect.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Katie, thank you so much for helping me out here.
Anytime, David.
Katie Workman is the author of the Mom 100 cookbook, and she blogs at the Mom 100. Call in at 800-537-5252. And we have Greg on the line. Welcome, Greg. Where are you calling from?
sunny Seattle, Washington.
So tell me, Greg, what is your question?
So when I'm trying to be good and control my blood sugar with diet and exercise, I tend to eat a lot of crunchy vegetables. And I'm looking for some good quick pickling recipes with very low sugar or no sugar because, you know, there's only so much you can do with salad dressing and cheese.
Oh, I hear you. I hear you on that one, Greg. Pickling recipes that have not a lot of sugar. There is one, if I'm not mistaken, it is in an Alice Waters cookbook. And it's David Chang's recipe for salt and sugar pickles. And it's very quick, very easy, and extraordinarily low sugar. And a matter of fact, extraordinarily low salt. What you do is you get your vegetables, let's say radishes, daikon, maybe even seedless watermelon. That'd be kind of fun too. And you mix 1 teaspoon of fine sea salt with 1 teaspoon of sugar. That's it. So you chop up your vegetables. Let's say it's 1 daikon, a bit of a watermelon, maybe a cucumber, a radish or two. Just slice them up thinly, put them in small bowls, and just sprinkle a little bit of that salt sugar mixture over the top. Let it sit for 5 or 10 minutes, stirring it occasionally. And it brings out a lot of the flavor. And if you want to go for a little extra, take some Aleppo pepper and crush it between your fingers and put it over the watermelon. Maybe even a little bit of like feta cheese. That could be good too, even though this is not a pickle recipe at this point. But that will get you some of that same flavors you're looking for, and it's very easy.
That sounds really awesome.
It's simple as can be.
Yeah, and it's something that I can do, you know, like when I get home instead of, you know, taking 3 hours in the kitchen.
Well, that's the thing. As soon as you get home, chop them up, sprinkle. 10 minutes later, you're eating them. That's the best thing.
Yeah. Thank you, David.
All right, Greg. Thanks for calling. We really appreciate it. Next up, we have Rebecca. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
Where are you calling from, Rebecca?
I'm in Cassopolis, Michigan.
So tell me, what's your question?
My question is, I live in the country, and I have 2 fireplaces, one with a wood insert and one a big open fireplace with doors, and I also have campfires frequently when it's nice out, and I like the idea of cooking in the fire, and I wanted to know some recipes that would be good and easy.
Sure, very creative. I like that. So cooking in fireplaces. Well, what comes to mind, I just want to give a caveat, because this is really important. Make sure that whatever wood you use is wood that you would want to put into your grill. Let's say things like oak or apple wood or hickory, only because if you use any of the conifer woods like pine or fir, it can actually be poisonous. I just want you to be careful. Not trying to scare you, just want you to be careful, okay? And
yeah,
now
I don't use
about
any of those. I use really good hardwood.
Excellent. So we're out of the woods on that. No pun intended. Now, I think if you think cowboy, you're going to be okay. Right? Cowboys were out there in the open plain and they were cooking like you do over campfires. So I think anything that you think that cowboys could have, you could do, which means that using cast iron skillet or a cast iron Dutch oven is going to get you very far. So things like you can do steaks, you can do eggs. One of the things I love to do on the grill, which I think would be great in the fireplace, is taking some potatoes, thickly slicing them about 1/4 inch, thinly slicing some onion, throwing in some unpeeled garlic, different herbs. A lot of times I'll use thyme, I'll use rosemary, mix it all up with some olive oil, and just really sear those potatoes, put salt and pepper till they get really dark and real crusty, and they're fantastic. And that's something you can easily do while you're watching the fire. Another thing, kebabs. Kebabs would be a great thing. Some lamb or beef or chicken with some vegetables. That'd be kind of fun. And, you know, I don't know, this is kind of out there, but do you know Jim Leahy's no-knead bread recipe? It's done in a Dutch oven. And you make the dough, you put the dough in there, you cover it. I think that would do really well. I think you could probably knock out a very decent loaf of bread for your kebabs or whatever you put in that skillet, or your maybe baked beans even, in a cast iron Dutch oven.
Yeah, I love beans.
All right.
Sounds really good. I'm going to make some potatoes tonight.
All right. Well, keep those fires burning. Thanks for calling, Rebecca.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye. Hey, wait. I got to stop here. Oh, man, I had a blast. Thank you for joining us today. The Splendid Table's new host, Francis Lamb, will be here next week. In the meantime, let me leave you with this quote from MFK Fisher. First we eat, then we do everything else. You can find all the recipes you heard about on today's show and information on our guests and their books at splendidtable.org. Be sure to register for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, subscribe to the weekly Splendid Table podcast, and register for this month's giveaway. You'll find it all at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table team is made up of our senior producer, Jennifer Russell, and production assistant, Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm David Leet, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.